Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Hello, my name is L.S. Kim. I am a professor of television studies, feminist criticism, and Asian American cultural production. I am so pleased to be here. Thank you, Toby Miller.
Well, thank you, and it's exciting to have you here. I've read your work for many years, and now we're having a chat. So I wonder if I could start out by asking you what's going on for you here and now? What's currently dynamizing, impeding, fascinating, preoccupying you?
Yeah, always a good question that you begin your podcasts with. It's both open, but also allows us to be specific. And I will say what is simultaneously all those things. It's Asian Americans in media culture. The role that Asian Americans play, literally their role and also symbolically. And I think it's a particular time in the context of larger diversity discourses, which I find tricky and murky and necessary. Where are Asian Americans? In cultural representation, in academia, in the politics around what it means to broaden our vision, both on screen, as well as kind of in our social experiences. So I've been thinking a lot about my role as an Asian American female academic, as an Asian American person and daughter of immigrants, as a media scholar, who looks very intently and has for a long time at the representation of race, and in particular, right, at this, and there have been many moments, right, but this particular moment of Asian American visibility, and I am trying not to have a cynical tone in my voice. I'd rather characterize it as cautiously optimistic. And in particular, in answering your question, I think it's been about almost exactly a year since the Oscars 2023, when Everything Everywhere All at Once won for Best Picture. And there was a growing narrative about Asian Americans in the US, in Hollywood in particular, kind of having their celebratory, again, moment. How has that been mobilized? By whom? And so I think, as you know, Toby, as academics, on one hand, we do this cultural analysis. We do, and we spend the time doing the analysis that those who are in some ways making perhaps don't have the time or inclination or interest in doing. But I think we take our observations and we formulate critiques, but we also want to formulate and generate ideas and strategies. And that's a similar take that I have in the book, which we may end up speaking about it as well. What can we do that is more directly an intervention? How can we convert, kind of celebratory talk, right, or talking big, into steps? Where, for lack of better phraseology, ch change happens in our social and visual culture.
Oh, pardon me. And Prof, you said you wanted to keep out any note of cynicism from your tone as you were speaking. And I'm interested in asking whether there is a sense in which, following a century or more of stereotypes of a very limited kind, we all deal in stereotypes always, of course, but the question is how broad they can be, how much diversity they allow for, and how much control over one's own stereotypes particular groups have. But there having been a certain change in stereotypes over time and some opportunities, nevertheless, the idea of being a flavor of the year makes one wonder whether change is really occurring. Did I hear any sense of that in what you were saying?
That's part of it, yes. I mean, I will say tropes, right? Visual shorthand. I mean, that is how visual language and visual vocabulary works, right? It's about legibility. You see an image in an instant, it is read, interpreted, misinterpreted. It helps to build your understanding of that particular, fictional narrative, and you move on. Stereotypes are always relative. They're constantly changing. And so I also question and want us to think about the time frame in which we allow, right, or accept certain representations, because now we look back 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, oh, that was unacceptable. But at the time, obviously it was not to an extent. So what do we have now that we accept that in 5 or 10 years we'll say, oops, right, at the minimum, or that was not just incorrect, but that was damaging and hurtful. So on one hand, yes, a history not just of stereotypes, but of the practice of doing what's easy, right? The iconic shorthand. But I also am interested in how, because this relates, so I am reading two articles during my spring break. I may or may not assign them in my class that begins in 2 weeks. At the intersection of the model minority myth and anti-Blackness, from Asian American triangulation to recommendations for solidarity, by Sherry Wong and Bianca Santos, professors at Santa Clara University. And then there's this excellent, important piece that was written by Claire Jean King, Kim, The Racial Triangulation of Asian Americans. So there is a longstanding pattern of the question of placement of Asians, and in particular, Asian Americans, right, in the US context, in the frame of this black-white dynamic. How do you, as the question goes, how do you move beyond the black-white? And so I think, along with the history of cinema culture and the history of representation for 100 plus years, is this question of what about the figure of the Asian American? Because there is, on one hand, a proximity to whiteness, an aspiration, phrases like white adjacent or honorary whites. There also is a way in which clearly Asian Americans are people of color. And so we ally with the history and the experiences of African Americans, not in detail, but right in a larger racial hierarchy where there's clearly whiteness, white privilege, oppression, exclusion, limitations to livelihood and opportunities. So there is this kind of in-betweenness. So how that relates to the Oscars and awards and the shifting narrative that I observe between, say, AFI awards, which come out in the US, the American Film Institute, December, mid-December. Then we have Golden Globes in January, Screen Actors Guild Awards, kind of every few weeks, it's a party, and an awards show. And I was just speaking with my students in my winter quarter course about feminism and the media. What is the significance of the awards shows, of winning an award, right? Of being named an Oscar award winner. And so by the time we got to Everything Everywhere All at Once, winning Best Picture, the two Daniels directors, including an Asian American director, and the stars, Michelle Yeoh and Kiwi Kwan, we have, particularly in the figure of Kiwi Kwan, who I think more people and audience members, listeners here may know as Short Round in the Indiana Jones film. He had his comeback 40 years, but he had his comeback, and that happens in Hollywood. But his language was so full of gratitude, which is his personality and which is cultural and which was lovely. But it was folded into the understanding that Asian Americans, right, as a minority group, are those who are patient and gracious and thankful. And it became that kind of direction, that kind of guideposts that Asian Americans working in media have been given, right? We will reward or award you, just keep being patient and gracious and grateful, right? Which is a very different kind of social or political movement than BLM, right? Black Lives Matter, or any other kind of way that you know, indigenous actors and filmmakers, right? Each, if you will, not to be so categorizing, but you know, each kind of group or cultural group or professional group has their strategies and they are perceived in certain ways. So I feel that in looking at Asian Americans, their roles in media cultural production right now, they have been given the same line that they have
Right,
in
so we're
American
not getting
culture for a long time.
the angry Asian making demands is not one of these items
Correct.
on offer.
Right, that it's just another iteration of the model minority myth, right? This is the social contract, and also what's difficult with the model minority myth is, you know, it leverages and it pits racial groups against one another, rather than, you know, this article is recommending solidarity, right, among Blacks and Asians. So I see that not completely, but that's my caution in looking at how projects are getting green lit. They're getting the green light with Asian Americans. You know, Asian Americans, their Instagram and their you know, formerly known as Twitter tweets. You know, their coverage in popular press. It's all very celebratory. And for them, I am truly happy. And, you know, 2 degrees of separation, I have had the chance to get to know and meet and interview with, as they're now called, creatives, Asian American creatives. So the celebration is warranted, merited, and I'm happy for them, sincerely.
Yeah.
But I also see that the celebration is a kind of self-congratulatory pat on the back, right, by those who really hold the power.
Now, Prof, one of the things for the 75% of listeners who are not US people to know is that one of the arguments made about the difficulty of creating alliances amongst the groups you've mentioned is class difference. And this is something that you confront head on in your Bravura book, wonderful book, made for television. And this is a homonym for those listening. It's not, especially if English is not your first language, I should say it very clearly. It's M-A-I-D, not M-A-D-E. And you're writing about maids on television, and you're doing so in a way that shows that through successive periods of US TV history, different racial groups are allotted these roles. And this shows that there are some class interests of that bind together in certain ways different racial groups in a similar sort of role, albeit in different historical moments. I think you can explain that much better than I can. But if you could explain to us how you look at the different racialized figure of the maid in US media history, that would be great.
Yeah, thank you for making the connection. I mean, I'm still in the midst of our conversation doing that myself, which is the methodological approach in the book, Made for Television, Race, Class, Gender, and a Representational Economy, is to do a cross-cultural, interracial study. And at the same time, right, recognize the difference and the commonality, which I think is the connection and the analogy to racial politics, particularly in the US today. What are the differences? What is the common ground? So in the book's subtitle, A Representational Economy, I think you're asking me to elaborate a little bit about that. And, you know, I can say that I started the book many years ago because I was simply looking for women of color, characters, faces, images. What are the storylines? How are they given time and place and attention and care if they are, you know, on the small screen? And I will say, by the way, there are more women of color seen, featured in television than in film in the US. So a pattern emerged: a maid, a housekeeper, a nanny, another maid. And so I tried to widen the scope of the research and the study and look across the different women and the different racial groups to understand a larger pattern. So this idea of a representational economy, simply put, is there can't be too much difference, right? That there is a budget and there is whiteness at the center. There is the American family, which is traditionally, and I put traditional in quotation for those of you who are listening, a traditional family, which is white. And then we have a series of servants of color, African-American, Asian-American, white ethnic, which is an interesting way to draw out the class differences, Latina, some men of color as well. And so they sort of rotate in and out of this role because in the household, you cannot have too much difference. On the screen, you cannot have too much difference. There also is a certain kind of chronology, but you know, I want to be careful about not being fixed. But in the 1950s, right, kind of the historical employment pattern in the US, as well as according to US television, in the 1950s, we have a plethora of domestics, African-American women, many who migrated from the US South to the North and the West. In the 1960s, Asian-American servants we see in television programs. And it's not coincidental, one of my arguments in this representational economy and also what I call a certain kind of displacement is, well, what's happening in the 1960s in the US, the civil rights movement, right? So there is a particularly close eye kept on how African-Americans are represented and also giving African-Americans employment opportunities as performers or writers or directors. Mm-hmm. And so no longer are they domestics. Instead, they're displaced by Asian American servants. In the 1990s, we have Latina servants. And so there's a way in which there's a maintenance of what is not only understood as a kind of baseline picture of the American family as white, but also a way to maintain and contain racial difference.
And getting back to the Asian word, LS, I'm wondering if we could, or you could help us a bit with unpacking that, because on the one hand, we see decades when Hollywood gets people like me to play Asians of different kinds, or we see decades when Hollywood gets somebody who is meant to be Japanese and is actually Filipina or vice versa, right? Where there is a pan-Asian notion that doesn't fit people's physiognomies, hair, look, speech, anything, but it is allowed, right? And there is, in a sense, a problem with the term Asian American because it is flattening out some key differences and key differences in the historical experience of coming to the United States as well. So if you look at the story of Asian American representation in US TV, are you seeing particular kinds of Asianness privileged or silenced or stereotyped?
Yes, in some ways, to answer your question, I think about, a broad history and excuse my US-based framework, but a history in Hollywood in which up until 1942, there's a certain kind of interchangeability among people of Asian extraction, right, of Asian descent. Once World War II began, Japanese characters and Japan became enemy number one. That was reflected in Hollywood stories. And there was a turn to having sympathy towards Chinese characters, right? So The Good Earth by Pearl Buck was made with an actress in, as you described, yellow face. I mean, no lead characters were ever actually cast. Asian Americans were not cast in the role. And Yellowface surprisingly lasted a very, very long time. I mean, into the contemporary era. So there's a way in which, film culture recognized, if you will, some modicum amount of ethnic specificity, but only in the service of, kind of US national policy. So, when we were in the military conflict with Vietnam, then there's some cultural specificity in, essentially a demonizing or denigrating Vietnamese. So in some ways, the ethnic specificity only comes when it is to the benefit of kind of propelling a certain US national identity or Western perspective. It wasn't for the benefit of the actors nor the characters. In television, I'll say that what is so fascinating with the case study of The Courtship of Eddie's Father, this television program that ran at the end of the 1960s and starred Miyoshi Umeki, the only Asian American woman to have won an Academy Award. Until Michelle Yeoh, Michelle Yeoh, I believe, is not a U.S. citizen, but nonetheless, right, embraced by Asian Americans and kind of read as Asian American, in as much as the project for which she won was directed by Asian Americans, and it was in the English language, and it was set right in the U.S. But Miyoshi Umeki, not many people know, is the first Academy Award-winning actress of Asian descent. She immigrated here in her 20s. She was a torch singer, then moved into film, and then at the end of her career, television, and stayed in the US, was married, had a child, quietly retired to the Midwest. So, by that definition, or according to my definition, Asian American. Her Japanese-ness in this text, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, is recognized, respected. There is some orientalizing, but there is also a way in which there is cultural exchange. James Cormack, the producer, knew Miyoshi Umeki's work as a film actress and out of being a fan, invited her to be a part of this television series. It's based on a novel in which Mrs. Livingston is not Japanese American. And one could ask either way, right? Why, again, if you're going to give a role to an Academy Award-winning actress, whether Hattie McDaniel from Gone with the Wind, who starred in Beulah as a maid, or Miyoshi Umeki, from a film called Sayonara, in which Marlon Brando was in, to this television show, why the figure of a maid? But nonetheless, James Cormack did it out of respect for her work, her skill, her talent, and she plays the role beautifully. So there is a way in which her Japanese, heritage and background is acknowledged and in nice ways. What is fascinating about the text is that it pushes against the limits. They are almost, Right, a family. It is almost an interracial marriage and relationship. My chapter in Made for Television on Asian American Servants is all about kind of lost opportunities in looking at how the narrative structure, how the production almost makes strides, right? Okay, so this is late 1960s until 1971. I would say now there tends to be either kind of pan-Asian-ness, but in support of and recognizing, you know, that there is an Asian American experience. I mean, a few short years ago, there was no understanding about an Asian American experience. It really was Asian. And needing to make that distinction between Asian and Asian American. Now we're slowly, barely beginning to see that reflected. Michelle Yeoh, just the Brother's Son, a Disney series, was just canceled. But Michelle Yeoh, and this happens too, right? One figure kind of skyrockets and then gets all the projects. So she starred in a series with her two sons, and it is specifically their ethnic cultural experience. There was a great series out of Canada, Kim's Convenience, a few years ago. It was based on a stage production, and it was specific to Toronto and to Korean American immigrant experience. So I am seeing some specificity. But I also am seeing, you know, as you had asked, old patterns. So, without going too much into it, right? It's often first generation immigrant experience, right? Not second generation or beyond. I mean, clearly there are Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans who've been in the country for over 100 years, 5 generations longer than, you know, many other white immigrants, for example, and martial arts. I mean, martial arts are cool. Martial arts are visually impressive, but we kind of have there's an inclination to go-tos, and what I'm yearning for is to see the unexpected, and I saw it in one series very recently, which swept the Emmys, Beef. With Steven Yeun and stand-up comedian Ali Wong, written and directed by a Korean American. So yes, their specificity there also is kind of fallback to expected narratives and visual aesthetics, if you will, of how an Asian face or body, even if embodied by an Asian American character, presents on the screen.
And one of the things that has happened over the last decades is that Japan, having long been a key market for Hollywood, I'm thinking of cinema here, now China has become the biggest market commercially. And, you know, if you put China and Western Europe together, they just dwarf the domestic box office. Unless you include Canada, which Variety likes to do. Variety likes to make Canada domestic, charming, right? In amongst that, there has been a certain desire to, at different times, tailor films to what foreign audiences will want, right? Or imagine what foreign audiences will want. In television, this has often led historically to incredibly restrictive racial roles, because there was a theory that you couldn't sell black TV, black themed drama, for example, in Eastern and Central Europe. This was a perspective of TV sellers in the US, right? That also influenced what was made. So my question on this is, now that we've seen the fetishization almost of aspects of Korean popular culture, not only in the United States, but in East Asia as well, and in Australia, an interest in K-pop, an interest in Korean TV, etc. Is that external depiction of Asianness in popular culture having an influence on what gets done on US television?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are scholars who specifically look at K-wave, the Korean wave, and then in very recent times, trying to translate that for what it may or may not mean for Asian Americans and their professional opportunities in the media. I think it goes back to narrative expectations. The Asian face on screen. And as you were speaking and formulating your question, I was thinking about, in some ways, I think it's a US media failure to not be able to make legible Asian Americanness. And so when an Asian American face or star or film, Crazy Rich Asians reaches a global zenith in popularity, how might that affect the ways in which Asian Americans in the US are able to kind of advance their careers? So I will say a general interest is working. Because it's as simple, Toby, as s becoming accustomed to an Asian face on screen, to beginning to understand that an Asian American or Asian male body is romantic and sexy and desirable and a lead, right? That has not been experienced in the West, or I will say in the US. It is retraining or reorienting, right? Your aesthetic tastes, your visual pleasures, and again, your understanding of the direction of a story. Who are the lead characters? I say to my students all the time, we're so acculturated in such narrow ways in terms of how we expect our film or television experience to go, right? Beginning, middle, and end. 2 hours, happy ending. We know who the lead characters are. We know who, by race. We know who the supporting characters are, or in a horror film, who's going to get killed first. So your question is really about, I think, a kind of global, to shine the guilt on U.S. audiences to acculturate them to heroizing, admiring, becoming fans of K-pop stars, K-drama actors, Korean film directors. So, of course, I mean, cinema has been around in Korea for 100 years, more than 100 years. But speaking again, Academy Awards 2020, Parasite won. So, I think while there is a growing getting used to seeing and understanding Asian characters as leads and as compelling as worthy of our time and affection, that there remains an ignorance, right, or a lack of opportunity to know specifically who these characters are, or what countries or cultures they come from. There have been more recently, for example, Korean stars, the star of Squid Game, who walked the red carpet in LA. And the reporter blissfully asked, how does it feel to become so famous? And of course, he's had a career in Korea as a famous actor for 3 decades. So again, the cautious optimism, I think, is one of the themes.
I guess related to this is that there are two elements to representation, at least, but two obvious ones. Representation on screen, representation off screen. And you've mentioned the importance of having a diversity of directors and so on, and this applies as well to things like screenwriting and producing and being an executive, having the power to green something, to use studio speech. So I wanted to ask you a bit about that, because one of the things that, again, getting back to the power of Japan, is that in the 80s there was this anxiety that Japan was taking over Hollywood. And Japanese money, I think, bought the Seattle Mariners, I think they were called, a baseball franchise. And a lot of the panics one sees about China today were exhibited about Japan in the 80s and 90s. But the two experiences of Japanese purchase of studios saw one just say, oh, let's just let the gringos run it. And that was Sony. And it's been tremendously successful. And the other was, we'll go in and make it different. And that didn't work. And I'm interested in the extent to which, when people move into decision-making positions of power, they take with them and are informed by their feminist politics or their cultural politics of race or whatever it might be, right? Because we have now had female heads of studios in Hollywood. Not many people can notice much difference between their labor relations and those of the guys. But just apart from the Sony example, and there is now some Chinese money, of course, in a big way in Hollywood, there hasn't been a real expansion of opportunity for Asian executives at the top decision-making levels. And there's still lots of work being done to establish what the opportunities are as a screenwriter, as a showrunner, as a director, and in these other key creative positions. Now, you've spoken to a lot of these folks. So, what's your take on the relationship between these two kinds of representation? Representation on screen and representation behind the camera and in the executive suite.
Yeah, absolutely the right question or a good question to raise. I mean, there is the glass ceiling, particularly for Asian Americans and in many fields, if we're talking about a certain kind of class of professionals. And I think the examples that you have shared about Japanese moving into Hollywood production and more recently, China, studios, investors. There was the example right before the pandemic, actually the weekend before in at least by the time the pandemic reached the US, the lockdown, Disney's live action Mulan had its premiere at the Grauman Theater in Hollywood.
Ramen's
And then
Chinese.
yes, Grauman's Chinese theater, it was all very, decked out in red. And then it never had theatrical distribution. But there was an example of a film, a Disney film, right? Very American, Chinese, co-production, Mandarin subtitles. Gong Li was in the film. So there are these ideas about what will work in terms of a particular economic model. But it still remains right offshore or on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. There is a way, I think, where some opportunities are being given to Korean directors. But it is about an investment, and it is, not surprisingly, we're not here to discuss or judge, kind of the profit model. But your question, why it's so important, is we're talking again about separating, right, between Asian and Asian American. And what about the professional opportunities for Asian Americans in on the creative side, producers, executives, writers, casting agents? And I think casting is key. And I tell my students a key place for activism to happen, casting choices, the work of casting. But I think there still is quite a fight, when we are talking about What's quite popular here in the US, DEI, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion, that somehow Asian Americans have been forgotten or left out of that equation. And so while rightfully and necessarily so, certain writers, directors are given opportunities, the green light. Asian Americans aren't part of those initiatives, or not as much. And so, we've heard the argument before, and I think it stands. We still we not only need more Asian American directors and writers and producers and executives, we need those career opportunities to be attended to. And I know that there are people who are fighting for that. And in some ways, this is what happens in star discourse. You start out in front of the camera, on screen, you gain some clout, you gain credibility, star power, then you become a producer and or a director, and you can move behind. There are Asian American writers, but often, again, that doesn't have the same kind of visibility, particularly in film. So that is in progress. And again, cautious optimism. But a lot of work needs to be done to give those opportunities to Asian Americans, or to, I shouldn't say give, right? To open the door, the doors. Because I think pulling back to this context of the diversity discourse, Asian Americans are not particularly of concern for many.
Now, listeners, we have to give great plaudits to the prof for reasons that won't have been obvious to you, which is that I was pulling extraordinary faces while she was answering that question because the podcat turned all the lights off. And then when I went over to turn the lights back on, which requires using your foot in order to push one of those buttons that's on the floor, he put my foot in his mouth and bit it. And then wouldn't let me move my foot as he held it in place with his paws. So I was grimacing and the lights were coming and going. And I think this means I need to give him his midnight snack. So my
I think it
apologies.
means your podcat, and I feel lucky that the podcat made an appearance. Your podcat has something to say. We just don't know what. I mean, I think there are in our conversation continuing question marks, and I just thank you and the listeners for giving some time and attention to this question of Asian Americans
We can
and the
keep going.
media.
We can keep going. Don't worry, please, if you don't mind. If I could just quickly give him his midnight snack, and we can keep going a little bit longer. If that's okay, Prof.
Sure, yes.
Great. It's just that this will calm him down. Normally, the midnight snack can actually wait until midnight, which isn't for another hour. But for some reason, he got very exercised and very excited. I've only recently discovered that apparently 80% of orange cats are male. Did you know this, Prof?
I did not. I had a black and white cat. When I was young, but perhaps a tabby or a yellow or an orange cat would be nice to have now.
Well, this is Garfield. He's sort of a Garfield figure, and apparently Garfields are predominantly male. Anyway, back to these. Of course, this question's important for me, but back to questions that are more important for all of us, namely this question of this relationship between the two kinds of representation. Are there ideas that you have, or that social movements have, for how this situation could be rectified? In terms of more opportunities, let's say for Asians and Asian Americans in these decision-making positions, be they the financial ones or the creative ones, if one can make that distinction. Let me give you a case, an instance of why I think this should be done differently. All over the world, both in Asia and elsewhere, Hollywood benefits monumentally from public subvention. It's often hidden, but it's there. Lots and lots of public money. And right across the United States, TV shows are shot in New Mexico or Georgia or Louisiana because the public puts dime behind the process. Not necessarily because, as Hollywood would tell you, there's wonderful scenery or gifted workers or any of that. It's about public money. Well, it seems to me that rather as in the case of arguments for national broadcasters or national cinemas, which are that this can reflect a people to itself, right? So this should be supported by public money. So in the case of Hollywood, a case should be made for saying, you guys are on the government dime, but you won't admit it. And part of the responsibility of being on the government dime is being accountable to citizens. And that means diversifying who gets to spend the public money. This is not an argument that is used in Hollywood, as far as I know, because no one wants to talk about it. But that, it seems to me, along with an argument about natural justice and talent and efficiency, is crucial to changing the dynamic that we still have of racial exclusion as well as stereotyping. So I'm interested in what you would do, or what, if you were in a position of authority of some kind, which you are, but more scholarly authority, to try to shift this situation. How would you organize people to make it different?
Big question, and I think it's also about how would one organize different groups of people, right, to bring about change. As you were speaking, I was thinking of, I think it's Will Smith who said green is the only color that matters in Hollywood. A bit facile, but also true. And so I think if we are speaking to groups of people whose mode and purpose is to turn a profit, then you give them examples. So summer of 2018, for if you will, if we can call it that, Asian American cinema, there were three big hits that did have an impact and shift some production directions in Hollywood thereafter. So in the summer of 2008, we had Crazy Rich Asians. We had The Farewell, a small independent film directed by Lulu Wang, starring Awkwafina. And then there was another independent film shot partly in the Santa Cruz, beautiful Santa Cruz Mountains, called Searching, starring John Cho, who is an actor many, I think, who are listening and certainly in the US would recognize. He has done mainstream work as well as independent Asian American work. And so, because particularly Crazy Rich Asians did so well, I mean, I saw it on the airplane ride that I was emailing you about recently. It's available widely, widely, and people love it. And, one could say it is a certain kind of wealth porn, right? And it's not even set on US soil, but certainly, right? There's Asian cultures, there's Asian American or Chinese American culture, particularly the main female lead. Because it did well, there were projects both on film and in television that were given a shot. And were, kind of made the rounds in Hollywood and got the green light and were moved into development. And so that had an effect, right? If you have one example, then you get, similar work that is done. But I think also to address your question, I mean, in the 1960s, talking about government, there was a government mandate through public television to provide financial support and to also make sure that certain broadcast programming was available to the different racial groups, including Asian American. So that was a particular small model. I'm not sure, 50 years later, to what degree something like that exists. But we're also talking, if you will, not to dichotomize, right, or make a binary, but mainstream mass culture, right, and kind of niche educational television. There is, though, still a bit of that. So in May, right, this coming spring, it's at least in the US, Asian American Heritage Month, and you will see promoted more films, literature, television, musical performances by Asian Americans happening. But I think also to answer your question, we really need social activism, political agitation, because we're talking about an expressive art ultimately, right? Media creation. How do we push for change? I will say, for example, Oscars, hashtag Oscars So White, which started before the pandemic, so 2000, before 2019, that in some ways, I think white liberals were guilted, right, into diversifying members of the academy. Whatever the reason, whether it was sincerity or guilt, we then had a voting membership that did affect and shift the way, right, that films are not only recognized, but that are given attention to. And so I think Asian American work, Asian American writers, directors, executives, they need to be recognized. They need to be regarded. They need to be respected. And that will not just happen on its own. I write in the book that there is a very easy and utterly passive position to social change in regard to race in the media, which is, things get better with time. Maybe, but actually things change because people push for change. And I think the professionals, Asian American professionals, they have so much that they're doing to merely survive in their career track that it's going to take others to push on their behalf. And there are media organizations for sure. But as a professor and as someone who thinks about and writes about and teaches students about, I will, come back to this idea of the audience, right? The viewers really, in some undeniable way, have the power to make things happen differently.
And
And so, maybe
okay.
it's too strong a reliance upon viewers, but that is also why I think teaching and talking and writing about representational culture and cultural production and viewers' role in it, I hope that message is shared.
Prof, we've been focusing mostly on drama. I'm thinking now in terms of Who Killed Vincent Chin? A very famous documentary from the late 80s about the terrible killing of an Asian man that was anti-Japanese in the minds of the white guys who did it, even though he wasn't Japanese. And this was part of, I think, what was impelling my question about a poly-Asian notion. One of the things we saw during the first couple of waves of COVID-19 was anti-Asian hate and marches by Asian folks of all kinds of backgrounds against this, and billboards in LA saying things like, "You love our food, don't hate us," words to that effect, right? Very effective, I thought, or at least very clever. I don't know how effective in terms of the audience. I'm wondering if you could help us come to terms a bit with some of that experience of anti-Asianism, which has a very long history, although a complicated one in the US, and is also part of our contemporary moment.
Who Killed Vincent Chin is a great film, co-directed and co-created by a colleague of mine, Renee Tajima Pena. She taught at UC Santa Cruz for a number of years and now is head of the Asian American media program at UCLA. So your question about nonfiction, right, and documentary form and in some ways social justice media. And you're right that the story is so tragic and angering and compelling and important because Vincent Chin was Chinese American adoptee, mistaken for Japanese American, Japanese even. During the 1980s, this sort of resentment and fear about a Japanese incursion and in Detroit and the car industry was beaten to death with a baseball bat, right? American pastime. And so there's so much in that story that is representative, right, of the place of Asian Americans not belonging in the US, of this easy kind of conflation between Asian Americans and foreigners. There is another phrase that describes Asian Americans, perpetual foreigner, you know, no matter how many generations and no matter if you speak English accentless. It's the confrontation with the Asian face, the Asian presence, right? Both in real life and on screen. How is that going to be managed? How is that? What are the trained reactions to that? And one trained reaction to Vincent Chin was, I despise, right, this figure. It's dehumanizing. And so with that film, when you mentioned the title, immediately what came to mind is interviewed in that film is civil rights attorney Helen Jia, ZIA is her last name. And she said, no civil rights changes happen without activism. So what is also significant about the film, the film's capturing, is that it was a precedent-setting case. It was before hate crimes, you know, came onto the books. And so how are we going to measure or understand this killing as racially motivated? They ultimately did not. Ron Ebens, the killer, and his stepson, they were fined $300. And Ron Ebens, the father, spent one night in jail, right? That's what the case could produce legally. But I think in answering your question, it's a huge question about anti-Asian sentiment and how that is sustained and how that has a long, long history and what does it look like now when it's not so blatant and why. But there is this notion of Asians as perpetual foreigners. I also remember a particular scene in Who Killed Vincent Chin in which Japanese reporters came to interview Ron Ebens. They knocked on his door and he said, "Why are you here?" And there were subtitles. And so there's a way in which, you know, when in times of desperation, if you will, members of the long ago homeland, right, will understand and have a bond with Asian Americans, because for some, that separation is not there. So I think that, you know, anti-Asian crime and violence and derision and hate is still with us, you know, 2 years post pandemic. And I do feel that representational culture could help. I didn't tell you in our, you know, kind of pre-podcast discussion. I went to Smith College, a women's college in Massachusetts. My major was government, my minor was film, and I was interested in anti-discrimination law. And so, when I was deciding between law school and film school, besides the fact that I did not score well on the LSATs, I really saw and continue to see media culture as the terrain, right, for bringing about social change. I don't take representation lightly, and neither do you, right? And there's so many complexities to representation. It's not just the image or the visage or the character, it's the experience and the feelings. It's about empathy or compassion or identifying with the story and the person we see on screen. And I will say, certainly in the West, we have not provided the opportunity to identify with Asian and Asian American characters still. And we need desperately to do that. And that will take Asian American writers and executives and producers and directors to help. I mean, not exclusively, right? But it's part of our interest and part of our commitment. And so, the opportunities need to be made more plentiful.
Ellis, I have a couple more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish. Does that sound all right as a way of
Yes.
concluding? So,
Yes.
my first question relates to something that you mentioned very briefly earlier: diversity, equality, inclusion. This is a very hot ticket item in the United States at the moment. I wondered if you could give us some thoughts on that and what needs to be done, what doesn't need to be done, and so on, when it comes to the cultural production aspects of that.
I mean, in some ways, it's very simply put. And again, I say this without cynicism. DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, needs to be inclusive. And I can see, for example, in the field of academia, perhaps in politics, and certainly in the politics of Hollywood, that Asian Americans are not necessarily considered or have visibility in this last term, inclusion.
Inclusion.
And that has a long and complicated history. And going to the top of our conversation about the social contract, about you shall be rewarded and awarded, but your mode of being, right, non-white and a minority, that mode of engagement has been set. And you stay within those guideposts and just wait. I'm not suggesting that Asian American writers and producers and executives and directors and actors and musicians, that they are content with that mode of engagement. But that is the predominant message. And so to your question about DEI, I simply say DEI needs to also include Asian Americans. Because in many fronts, that's not happening.
And of course, that leads to splits in the sort of coalition that you were promulgating again when we were first speaking. So, my last question before throwing to you, now that I've rescued the podcat who managed to drag a huge beanbag on top of himself while you were answering my question, and he was pinned to the floor until I rescued him. So, again, I thank you for coming up with such a great answer while I was running around like a mad thing.
That is your current preoccupation and
Well,
Nightism is the
oh,
podcat. I admire his will.
he's got it. He's persistent. But Prof, I wanted to conclude by going back to made for television, race, class, gender, and a representational economy, and to ask you how you did it. How you found out all this stuff, apart from the theoretical apparatus and the political drive, how you found out about these successive cohorts in a way. of domestic servants, female domestic servants on US TV.
You know, it was an act of excavation, as we often do in cultural criticism and cultural studies. We have a question, we follow a trail. You know, I was going to UCLA for graduate studies, and so archives and libraries at UCLA, you know, in Los Angeles were available. But frankly, there also were not many women of color who had starring roles, and whose material was saved, right, in the archives or in the libraries. And like a scientist, you look for the patterns. And so I found the commonalities more than the differences. Each, if you will, racial group has their unique histories as racial groups, and settings as domestic servants, but their role in an American family, which is understood as right, white and middle class conceptually, those remain consistent, that it was to uphold whiteness and this visage of racial harmony, whilst the world outside was not so. And I also saw and see in television the potential, right? Because it's all about discourse, and discourse is not set. And television narratives in particular are open, not closed. So I maintain this belief that if not the system of Hollywood, the system of media creation provides some room for intervention. The intervention comes when there is a will, and I think, right, an informed will. And so, as professors, you know, our job is to share ideas and information, to motivate and possibly inspire future makers and writers and producers and directors. I have a former student who whose day job is editing, and who also is going to auditions and trying to, Asian American woman, trying to get roles, and has to some degree. So I think, in answering your closing question, what can we do, in addition to being attentive to Asian, broadly speaking, media production, which is so exciting, for example, in Korea right now. Of course, long legacies in Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, Japan, other countries as well. So being attentive to the work and the art and the contributions, but also being supportive of, I will say, Asian American media making. If there's a film festival, right? If there is a choice of on streaming, give it a try, give it a go, and understand that you, as a viewer, are contributing and supporting the growth of Asian American cultural production, Asian American media presence, and I will go so far to say Asian American cultural power.
And Prof, are there things you'd like to add to what we've discussed, either items we've not touched on or things that we did mention, but where you want to say some more?
I mean, I would love to talk with you again sometime, but I think for today and for our listeners, thank you all very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.